As an interviewer, my earliest and most formative experience of the journalist-subject relationship was a university assignment I did on political biography. Most students took the task literally, choosing to interview politicians of varying importance. I went for the then less well-known Australian author, Helen Garner. My interest in Garner had begun 8 years earlier when I was 10. My father brought home a tall man with long hair, faded jeans and leather boots. His name was Philip Fraser, and he was the editor of the underground newspaper The Digger, an Australian Rolling Stone. Times were changing in Melbourne and Phil was the man. At dinner he told us about a woman he was seeing. It was 1972 and she'd just been sacked by the Victorian Education Department for giving frank sex lessons to high school students. She had written a piece about her sacking for The Digger. Philip's descriptions made this woman sound heroic and a martyr, as well as a good writer. By the time he screeched away drunkenly from our quiet suburban street in his yellow, home-tailored convertible Ford Falcon, I knew Helen Garner was someone I'd want to meet one day. When I approached her years later, Garner agreed to talk to me on the condition that the piece was not for publication. When she asked, I also confirmed that the interview would not be tape recorded and that I would send her a copy of it. Over a four-hour lunch, Garner and I talked in depth. I was starstruck as she spoke, as if to an equal, about feminism, politics, her life, her work, and her relationships. I wrote down her answers as fast as I could. Without a second thought, I proudly posted her a copy of what I'd written as soon as I'd finished it. I couldn't wait for her reaction. She was not pleased. On 10th of June 1980, she wrote to outline 15, she numbered them, inaccuracies she wanted cut or changed. But it was too late, as I'd already handed the work in. Her letter said, "I think I assumed a certain detailed knowledge on your part which shouldn't have been assumed. I suppose the gap between our ages makes that a difficulty. I also think that unless I have a false idea of the way I speak, you've somewhat distorted my tone, which in written talk exists in turns of phrase. Some of the turns of phrase you've attributed to me, I'm sure I would never have said in a fit. But that is just a matter of experience, I expect. I enjoyed the interview and learnt a lot from it. I hope it serves its purpose and that you get what you need from it." I wrote back apologising for the inaccuracies I was prepared to acknowledge and arguing the toss on others. Garner replied, saying she could see from the tone of your long letter that you were hurt and perhaps offended by mine to you. She apologised if I was rough or impatient, adding that I was too young to understand some of her nuances. "It is always traumatic to see the way another person has perceived you, especially when you feel you've talked a little too freely about things which would have needed much more careful explanation in order that they be fully comprehended by the other person. The oddest thing about the written interview for me was the strong sense of our being from different historical periods. This shocked me in the same way as one is shocked by any unexpected revelation of the fact that time passes. Also, I talked to you about things I ought not, like Bill and our marriage and subsequent events, not because they're secrets, but because, forgive me, you are too young for me to be so flip about it and for you to understand what's behind flip talk like that. As for the business of my father, that is a matter of such import for me, and I should have kept my mouth shut. I've learnt a lot, as I probably said, from all this, and I think you have to. Please forgive me if I've been offensive." When I look back on that assignment and Garner's handwritten letters, which at 18 I saw as so patronising and humiliating, I now know how she felt. I cringe at my spelling mistakes, careless segues, youthful presumptions, and yes, I am now old enough to admit any inaccuracies and misinterpretations. Where she had been flip, I had been flippant about her story in what I now see was my attempt to emulate the raw, edgy style of the underground press for which she had once written. The offence I took from the deft put-downs in her letters was based in part on my conviction that she had in fact said many or most of the things I quoted her as having said. But inexperience led me to be clumsy and to cut corners with expression. Without good shorthand and a tape recorder, it was impossible to defend my position that the substance of my version of the interview, despite its various errors and its overall inelegance, was true. I felt I had been damned on the basis of technicalities. Although I accept that the cause of my damning was more nuanced than that, it was the best lesson I ever got on the importance of technicalities. The American author Janet Malcolm notes, "The subject is Scheherazade. He lives in fear of being found uninteresting. And many of the strange things that subjects say to writers, things of almost suicidal rashness, they say out of their desperate need to keep the writer's attention riveted." I pondered the idea of interviewees' remorse. Garner and I agreed that we both enjoyed the interview, but later, as she wrote to me, she felt she had talked too freely. This is often the lot of journalist subjects. The disparity between the way Garner and I had each seen the interview shocked me. It formed the seed of what was to become my lifelong fascination with the psychological dynamics between writers and their subjects. I filed the offending assignment, for which I only got B-, and Garner's letters, away. I knew I would return to them one day.